Hi, and welcome back again to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Hunneke. I'm the co-chair of Hugh Subban Reed's Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice. With me, as always, is my good friend Brent Carlson, the director of the Berkeley Research Group. Today is Friday, June 27th, just before 12:30 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Brent, welcome, and how are you doing today?
Excellent. Thanks, Mike. Great to be here, as always.
Brent, today we wanted to do another fresh look at one of our prior Fresh Looks posts on the NYU Law School's program on corporate compliance and enforcement blog. Again, they've been a great friend to us and have politely hosted several of our posts in the past. In those posts, we tried to cover the waterfront from how do I assess my risks to, oh no, the government's here, what do I do? We also did an article on monitoring what matters, thinking ahead that an increase in export controls enforcement would carry with it post-resolution commitments. Sometimes those come in the form of voluntary commitments that are self-reported by the companies subject to these agreements about their compliance programs and what they plan to do. Other times there's an independent third-party consultant imposed as part of these agreements with the Bureau of Industry and Security. For those of you familiar with the DOJ monitors imposed as part of settlements between companies and the U.S. Department of Justice, it's the same basic idea. We wrote this post on monitoring what matters back in March of 2024. Thinking in particular, Brent, about maybe some unique aspects of national security-driven investigations and compliance that open the door for some creative thinking about how to do monitorships a bit differently in this space.
Both of us, you and I, Mike, have experience from the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act world in doing these sort of post-resolution projects, be it a monitorship, be it some sort of follow-up remediation plan, whatever you want to call it. We've been talking in terms of what are the needs now in the export controls world, driven by these national security priorities and geopolitical pressures. A typical FCPA monitorship would be a three-year adventure. Now, you and I, we have the opinion that there's no time for that. If we're looking at American products and technology that are dual use, that are going into military applications that could be used to harm U.S. military service personnel and those of our allies, you don't have time to be lumbering along with some big remediation program. You need quick hits right now, and you need to deal with the root causes very quickly.
Absolutely, Brent. This isn't a situation where the concern is to, over time, gradually reduce a company's exposure, frankly, to corruption of public officials through agents. This is about, as you said, items that the government's view is shouldn't be sent to certain people because they're going to do bad things with them as soon as they get them. We also brought into this piece, Brent, a lot of perspectives we had formed about really fundamental assessments of risk that we had also written about, and obviously we've spoken about on this podcast as well, as a way to indicate where monitors could focus. For example, it would be likely very much a waste of time and resources, and certainly of the company's money, to impose a third-party independent consultant on a company who then looks at, let's just say, all of the license applications for the last 5 years or 10 years, whatever it might be. The information is not sitting there that's really driving the real risks, especially when you're talking about perceived adversaries of the United States and very deliberate efforts by very sophisticated actors to trick companies. It's not going to be sitting there in the license application. It's the type of thing where you might see these risks is by taking a dynamic, holistic view at trade flows around key events, key geopolitical events, listings of people on the entity list, for example, or sanctions being imposed against certain countries or certain people or certain sectors. Really looking at, well, how did things change? When we lost that big customer because of a change in U.S. law, what filled the gap? When was it filled right away, and how was it filled? Monitorship shouldn't be in and of themselves a career for the people being the monitors. They certainly can lend credibility and lend valuable experience to that person's career. They may be career makers in that sense, but they shouldn't be careers. It shouldn't be industrial tourism, for example, for a monitor to go around and look at sites for 3 years. That's not really the national security risk. That's not where that risk lies. Brent, what did we think in particular about timing? We've mentioned already early on in this pod 3-year monitorships, and that was indeed baseline standard when you're talking about Foreign Corrupt Practices Act-based monitorships. But what were our thoughts here about timing? How much time, Brent, would you need to really get at these issues?
You got to take care of it right away. So we were thinking, like, bring this down to about a year. Once you get to the settlement, you kick off the post-resolution remediation program. You got about 2 months fact-finding, 1 month to implement. That's your first 3 months right there. Then at the 6-month month mark, you go look, you test it again, make sure that the wheels haven't fallen off the program, or there's something else out there that may have been missed before. Again, in a focused way, focus on what the issues and where the real risks are. Then take that to the 12-month mark with a final round of testing, make sure that it's all sound and secure, and then wrap it up and move on. One of the things we're thinking on this is also just getting out of that whack-a-mole type of approach. I think from both companies on the compliance side and the government on the enforcement side, everybody's just sick and tired of the whack-a-mole approach and trying to chasing these bad actors that just form shell companies whenever they need to. It's getting ahead of it. It's not only a shortened time frame, but it is also approaching the compliance program with that perspective of leveraging the full definition of knowledge under the EAR, which, as we've talked about and wrote about quite a bit, is not only includes actual knowledge, but also an awareness of a high probability. That goes back to what you're talking about, Mike. When you're focusing on these issues, we're not looking under every rock. That's a waste of time. That's just a snipe hunt, as we used to say in Boy Scouts. You got to focus on the real stuff. That goes back to timing. The most risky entities could be ones that are not, they're not going to be on a list. But the facts and circumstances of when they first came to a company as a potential customer, that's what's critical. And that can kick off the general Prohibition 10 issues and the whole issue of knowledge, and be quite dangerous for compliance programs and companies if they're not careful. But they can also leverage it to protect themselves in this day and age as well.
Right. And so just to step on a few key points that you make there, just for emphasis, Brent, there's a lot of value in that that's worth unpacking bit by bit. First off, the entity list is not the end all. It's a backstop. It's the government saying, for goodness sakes, we know these people are bad. Just please make sure at the very least you don't ship to them. But it's not really what's driving the risk going forward. Monitors, third-party independent consultants, they need to be taking a forward-looking approach. They are certainly not there to investigate the past. That's appropriately not the role. It's never been the role that the monitor should have assumed at all in any case. So it needs to be forward-looking. The entity list is all from the past. You're absolutely right. Where is the trick? Where is the scheme that's going to cause somebody to ship something indirectly to a bad actor that they will regret having shipped? It's all forward-looking, and we don't know in the future who's going to be on the entity list, right? The entity list is not forward-looking. The real risks and really national security interests of the United States are going to be better served by a monitor and a company working together who are forward-looking and thinking creatively about, okay, we all have limited time. We all have limited resources. Where do we think the biggest risk is of that real, that state-backed, military-driven, intelligence-driven diversion scheme really sits? Then assessing where that might sit with inputs that are more credible than just the normal self-provided information, including, frankly, self-provided end-user and user certificates. Do those make sense? Do the names of the customers make sense? Do they actually look, walk, and talk like end-users? You cannot do this if you have 100,000 customers. You can't look at suppliers like this if you have 100,000 suppliers without doing some kind of risk-based approach. And frankly, even in a type of risk-based triage, you're going to likely have to end up sampling, using your judgment to one form or another to find that. So any third-party independent consultant imposed in future Commerce Department settlements with companies should understand that standard and should embrace that standard in working with the companies. If that happens, our view of how long these things should take could actually be materialized. This is not a, let's think about it for 6 months, let's do two or three rounds of global tourism, let's do a 3,000-page report. This could be a, okay, let's come in, 3 months, desktop review, just by the names, just by the countries, just by the trade flows, what looks odd, then agree on approach for sampling, maybe doing a deep dive in very targeted ways to identify future risks, and then helping the company that's subject to this third-party independent consultant's support to build the right mindset and the right empowerment and the right tools to be a great corporate citizen from a national security perspective going forward.
Absolutely. To talk about prioritization in terms of prioritizing which of those rocks to look under, companies know their own business. You know your products, you know your applications. That's how you can prioritize. We put a couple quotes in our original NYU PCC article, Monitoring What Matters, to give a couple examples. Last year in 2024, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations was holding some hearings on American technology and products that were being recovered on the battlefields of Ukraine. It was very interesting. There was a gentleman from the UK's Royal United United Services Institute testifying on recovered components, he said, quote, these are very specialized pieces of equipment, particularly focused on the facilitation of artificial intelligence computations as a counter to prevalent electronic warfare. That's a prelude to where we are today. Anything AI-related, AI data centers, that's going to be a priority for the U.S. government as well.
Brent, that concept should be a key part of what informs the scope of the third-party independent consultant's work plan and how they go about it. For talking about government resources, company resources, and the imposition of independent consultants to help guide people post-resolution in the right way, that's the type of thing they should be focused on for sure. Another point that comes to mind, Brent, in thinking about those being the types of items that will really drive national security issues, wherever the battlefields might be, and unfortunately we see more and more battlefields these days than even when we wrote this article, is that many of these companies dealing with those types of items, manufacturers, design companies, anyone involved in the sales channel for those items, likely already has very well-meaning people working very hard around the clock on these issues. You do not need to monitor them independently to see, for example, are you doing KYC screening? Are you applying your existing procedures? Were you getting the end-use certificates that you needed to get in the first place? I think it's safe to assume all of that is happening, but we still see these challenges out there. Part of that is the sophistication of people on the other side, and part of that is a gap where a third-party independent consultant could really add real value.
On your point there, Mike, on how a yeoman's job a lot of the legal and compliance teams and companies are doing already to try to prevent diversion, there are still issues that need to be addressed because it's always an ever-evolving field. There's one other quote from the hearings that Senate PSI had last year where there was another gentleman from Conflict Armament Research, who said that there was a North Korean missile that was recovered in Ukraine, again, North Korean missile, that this organization documented more than 290 components, 75% of which were linked to companies incorporated in the United States, and more than 75% of the components indicated production between 2021 and 2023. So this is also indicative of, okay, this is a hole that is existing somewhere that needs to be plugged. North Korea has been sanctioned for a very long time, and to find these in a missile recovered in Ukraine is troublesome. Now we've had recent conflict in the Middle East where you've had Iranian missiles coming into Israel and also fired at U.S. military bases. That's also something that's going to have to be looked at very closely. Going to take that very seriously. A lot of enforcement people are veterans. The last thing that they're going to want to see are American products and technology that are going into military hardware bad actors or our nation's adversaries are using to kill Americans.
Well, Brent, what that gets to is a frequent challenge we hear about all the time in companies, certainly in the congressional hearings, it's come up in the media, it comes up all the time. Many of these companies are working through sales channels that are multiple layers deep and have a very valid question. Well, how far do I have to go? How far do I go into my distributor relationships? What about my distributor's distributors? What if there's a reseller? Even if that reseller is selling to a specific customer, what if I never even see them because they are three or four or five levels down? This is another area where there are big opportunities, not only for government and enforcement, but really also for companies in considering carefully the high probability standard, where you draw those lines about how far down your sales channel you go and what you do when you're down there are all things that should be tied back to your view of where are your highest risks. It's also important that those decisions are made based on an acknowledgement of the underlying economic realities of those relationships. What this means is that you get to draw the lines where you want to draw them, but you have to then defend it. And you can use the high probability standard to defend it. Let's continue with the example we're talking about here. Again, diversion of chips to North Korea or Iran. And I'm absolutely certain that's not direct sales, right? That's not direct sales from the manufacturers or design companies that are driving that. Well, there are some types of distributors and resellers that, absent specific allegations, which would be more of a red flag that you'd have to respond to as opposed to a compliance program design element necessarily, again, depending on the root causes that ultimately come out, is to look at whether the distributors are actual distributors, economic distributors. What do I mean by that? Are they buying inventory and then taking the risk of finding a customer for that inventory? The more that the distributor is following that model, the more they genuinely might not know who the eventual purchaser of that item is going to be, And they might actually be competing with some of the people selling these parts in some of the same markets or the same customers. On the other hand, you have what are more often called resellers, where they are a reseller selling to a specific customer or preparing a specific solution for a specific project or joint venture or something like that. Some of these projects, Brent, as you've pointed out before, if we're talking about data centers with the type of chips in it that really drive national security issues, these can be massive undertakings. Tens of thousands of people, huge campuses. You know when you're selling into something like that. And when you're building any kind of bespoke solution for a particular client, you're going to be assumed by the regulators as more likely having known what the ultimate end use or end user was. And those are the types of areas where you might go further down the chain, precisely because you know who the end user and the end use is. How much due diligence you do on different types of relationships will really depend on your business, on the geography of your customer base, and the types of industries that you're looking at. We have seen and heard from people who have experienced BIS outreach visits, for example, that BIS is also thinking the same way. What are your industry verticals? What are your service lines? Who are your customers? What can be accessed remotely and by whom? Are we just talking about software? Or are we talking about infrastructure, for example? All those things come into play and be part of a very open discussion with a third-party independent consultant, frankly, with the government, about how can these companies best protect national security interests, U.S. national security interests, post-resolution.
Absolutely. And another aspect that I think we should explore here when we're talking about specifically on these post-resolution remediation plans or projects is also the independence issue and oversight independence. We talk about this in our NYU PCCE article. It really needs to be free of any actual or perceived conflicts of interest. The national security issues that are given as reasons for these controls and mentioned in guidance is largely driven by concerns that the United States government has toward the People's Republic of China. It also has been widely reported that there's been lobbying by U.S. firms on behalf of Chinese companies linked to Chinese military. That could be a perceived conflict. The other issue is who is actually doing the testing of the new remediation steps that have been taken, the new controls that have been put in place, the new KYC due diligence procedures that have been implemented. Who does it is just as important as what it is. We've seen, for example, in the forced labor realm, Department of Homeland Security coming out with their guidance saying that they don't accept labor audits performed in China because of reported instances of intimidation and interference. So in that world of forced labor, you have that as guidance. Now, on that guidance itself, that Department of Homeland Security guidance, U.S. Department of Commerce also has its seal. So that concept of thinking about how effective are going to be, those on-site, let's say, audits or visits in country within the PRC, that's just questionable. In fact, that's not just questionable, it's just going to be very hard to do. Rather than thinking the old way where you're going to have to go and actually go and physically view and see this stuff, a lot of this information is just going to be data that you're going to already have, either in the company's books and records and within its data that it has across the enterprise and open source information that's available out there as well. Taking all that together, one will be able to triangulate whether or not you have potential issues thinking about the full definition of knowledge under the EAR, which includes an awareness of a high probability. That will give you enough tools to work with. Again, taking us out of that game of playing whack-a-mole and thinking ahead.
That's a great point, Brent, about this needing to be an exercise based on the data available to the company. If the whole objective of having an independent third-party consultant or a monitor in the context of a DOJ proceeding is really providing that extra assurance that the government thought was necessary that going forward, the company itself can handle these risks, it's got to be driven by what data do we reasonably expect the company to have? And on which data do we reasonably expect the company and the government to be able to rely? Coming back to independence, it was an interesting way you put it, Brent, and really it made me think about an important distinction in export controls and really any national security type of corporate resolution compared to FCPA. When we're talking about things that can hurt people, and that's why we have national security concerns over them, independence takes on a whole new meaning. To me, there's two aspects of independence. The first is the more traditional one, and one that was thought of constantly in the context of other corporate monitorships. Is the monitor independent from whom? From the company, right? From the company that they are monitoring. You can't, for example, have legacy advisors to the company regardless of what views they were taking about risks and how to manage those risks beforehand, also be the independent third-party consultant. There's another type of independence that, honestly, Brent, I wasn't really ever thinking of in the context of the FCPA enforcement regime, but does apply here, is independence not necessarily even from the company you're monitoring, which is important, but independence from other outside pressures that could have an equal impact on what you're willing to advise, what you're willing to say, and your ability to go about your business in an impartial and truly independent way. And that could include within your broader organization, if you're part of a big advisory group, a company, a firm, what ties do you have to the country that is relevant to the issue that led to the enforcement? It doesn't mean necessarily that anyone who has an office in certain places could not be an effective monitor over a company where the issues were exports to that country. But let's take even just domestic U.S. politics, for example. If you are lobbying on behalf of a country or the military of a country, that might create tension inside your own firm about whether someone else in the firm could be adequately independent in monitoring a company for issues related to exports to the same country. It might look a bit odd, especially even to the country at issue, for an independent compliance monitor to be part of the same organization as somebody lobbying on behalf of the country that is the focal point of the national security risks identified by the U.S. government. The U.S. government probably doesn't want that either. That's not something that, if I were in the Bureau of Industry and Security, I would want to have to answer questions from Congress about. Frankly, in this congressional environment, everyone involved, BIS, DOJ, companies, and any independent third-party consultants should be anticipating that there will be questions about any perceived conflict of interest.
Absolutely. It's a totally different world now. I think we need to recognize that.
Well, Brent, that leads us to some practical steps that we put at the end of our NYU PCCE post. And the first one was adopting a business as usual approach is dangerous. Do you want to unpack that a bit for the audience?
Yeah, this is where we talk about, again, how the world has changed. And we all have to recognize that. This goes back to what are the signals that BIS has been putting out and laying the groundwork for enforcement. You and I have talked about this. The signals are clear. They're referring to knowledge, quote unquote knowledge, under the EAR, which includes an awareness of a high probability. A few years ago, what may not be a high probability of evasion in 2021 might be today. But you may have to really be thinking about that. Boards of directors in their duties of oversight, which stem to the fundamental duties of loyalty, not to care, as we've written about in another NYU PCC article, need to be asking the management team and management team asking the legal and compliance teams, what do we know today? What do we think is really happening here? The risks are evolving quite quickly. Companies are going to have to get ahead of it.
Our second key takeaway, Brent, in this article was that perception is reality, or at least misperceptions impose real costs. And when I look at this now, I think back, Brent, to your original Fresh Looks article where loopholes create liability pitfalls. And as we've talked about, the loopholes aren't actually even loopholes, but they may be misperceived loopholes, misperceived technicalities. It's not that the law used to allow them and now it doesn't. I think, frankly, it's just perceptions about the enforcement environment may have led people to discount the consequences for working around the edges of where they thought the boundaries of the law and the expectations of BIS were. Well, if you look at the July 10th, 2024 guidance, the August 15th, 2024 TE connectivity enforcement action by BIS, the December 18th, 2024 report by the majority staff of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, and more recently, the May 13th, 2025 guidance from BIS, it's very dangerous to continue to misperceive those loopholes and technicalities as such, and certainly to continue to really rely upon them. If anyone is still taking an approach that might be a little aggressive in that space, there's still time. It's not too late, but it is time to really take a different approach and look at the signals coming out of government, because the government is going to certainly think that the signals that have come out, not only in those documents and those developments that I mentioned, but in guidance after guidance after guidance document, especially since Russia's further invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, be prepared to defend whatever due diligence was done and what decision-making was done. They will ask, what was the process for doing due diligence? Who decided and on what basis to do XYZ. That's coming.
Further to the concept of misperceptions imposing real costs, another article that we did in the NYU PCCE Fresh Look series was comparing the corporate settlement penalties between the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and export controls. They just really didn't stack up. You could see for the FCPA over the last 20 years, there were $30 billion in fines. What's really a key point here is that the definition of knowledge under the FCPA and the EAR is nearly identical. As Mike, what you've written about, that whole FCPA enforcement experience turned on that definition of knowledge. So we're looking at the same tool that can be leveraged by BAS here. This is where the cost thing comes in, because from a company perspective, look, they've got a million different things that could be potential risks out there. What are going to be the real potential costs to the company? Even if there is a violation, but it ends up just being a couple million bucks, I'm sorry, that's not a lot. That does not help any sort of legal and compliance team when they're talking about getting resources, because there's no ROI on that. And that it has to justify the investment that's going into building up and shoring up the compliance function. You could see the first shot across the bow in April 2023 with the Seagate penalty of $300 million. I think we're hitting into a world where if it truly is the policy of the United States to prevent the diversion of these critical dual-use items, we're going to see penalties go up. When that happens, then truly those become quote-unquote central compliance risks as well, because then that is completely unavoidable. I think we're on the cusp of looking at a whole new world in terms of penalties as well.
Absolutely, Brent. Brent, to conclude with our last takeaway from that article, don't lose sight of the forest for the trees. We closed with a quote from one of the expert witnesses in the Senate hearings. We should do our utmost best to prevent our technology being used in weapons that are designed to kill us and our friends. This is the core principle that really should drive not only corporate behavior, government enforcement behavior, but in the event that the government believes that there should be a third-party independent consultant imposed on the company who is reaching a resolution of a government investigation, that should drive the consultant's work as well. That is the mission, is to prevent that. You don't prevent that by troping around the world for 3 years and missing all the signals through the noise. You do that by a laser-focused effort, relying on all the information that company has already developed. Companies under investigation tend to make a lot of improvements to their compliance programs during an investigation. So even if an independent consultant is imposed, they likely are light years ahead already of where they were at the beginning of that government investigation. Monitors and consultants are always enabled and allowed to rely on information provided either by the company directly or through its advisors, who might be serving as buffer counsel one way or another between the company and the consultant. Everyone should be focused on that goal. Where are the biggest risks to national security, and how do we collectively align the company's course of direction from a compliance program perspective in the right direction so that they can independently help promote national security interests going forward? Well, Brent, I think that brings us to your Back by Popular Demand segment, Managing Up. Our guest in the last episode was so compelling that she may have stolen this from you. So I'm glad it's coming back to you. How are you going to reclaim the crown today, Brent?
First of all, I don't view it as stolen. I think what we did is we worked together to create something better than what any one individual person can do. So we are all in this together to make the world a better place. In terms of managing up, we just talked about don't lose sight of the forest for the trees. Avoid getting lost in those unimportant details. To this, I would add, let's also make sure we're focused on the right forest. We are living in this world where we can no longer play this whack-a-mole game. We know where to focus. Let's make sure we're focused on the right forest. That way we can do it to the right trees as well. Don't lose sight of the forest for the trees, and let's make sure that we're focused on the right forest.
So don't go running through the pine trees waiting for the leaves to fall.
That's right.
Well, Brent, as always, well said. That concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. Brent, as always, it was a pleasure. Be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.